Chapter 29. The Talbot stood in the Rubassano between a Renault and a Mercedes-Benz. The Mercedes was new and had an Italian license plate. Ravitch maneuvered the Talbot into the open. He was so impatient that he did not take sufficient care. The Talbot's back fender touched the left mudguard of the Mercedes and left a scratch. He paid no attention. Without pausing, he drove the car down to the Boulevard Haussmann. He drove very fast. It was good to feel the car in his hands. It was good against the dark disappointment that lay like cement in the pit of his stomach. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. He had intended to wait longer, but suddenly the whole thing seemed meaningless. Very likely Harker had forgotten the little episode a long time ago, or perhaps he had not returned to Paris at all. Just now they had other things to do over there. Morozov was standing in front of the door of the Scheherazade. Ravitch parked around the next corner and walked back. Morozov looked at him expectantly.
"Did you get my telephone message?"
"No. Why?"
"I called up 5 minutes ago. A group of Germans is sitting inside. 4 men. One of them looks like—"
"Where?"
"Next to the orchestra. It's the only table with 4 men. You can see it from the door."
"All right.
Take the small table by the door. I've kept it free."
"All right, Boris." Ravitch paused at the door. The room was dark. The spotlight was on the dance floor. A singer was standing in it, wearing a silver dress. The small cone of light was so strong that one could not recognize anything beyond it. Ravitch stared at the table next to the orchestra. It was not discernible. The wall of white shut it off. He took a seat at the table next to the door. A waiter brought a carafe of vodka. The orchestra seemed to lag. The sweet mist of melodies was creeping, creeping, slow as a snail. "J'attendrai. J'attendrai." The singer bowed. Applause broke out. Ravitch bent forward. He waited for the spotlight to be cut off. The singer turned to the orchestra. The gypsy nodded and took up his violin. The cymbals threw a few muffled notes into the air. The second song, La Chapelle au Clair de Lune. Ravitch closed his eyes. It was almost unbearable to wait. He sat upright again, long before the song was ended. The spotlight was cut off. The lights on the table came on, glowing. At the first moment he could see nothing but indistinct contours. He had stared into the spotlight too long. He closed his eyes and then looked up. He found the table at once. Slowly he leaned back. None of the men was Harker. He remained sitting this way for a long time. Suddenly he was terribly tired, tired behind the eyes. It drifted upon him intermittently in uneven waves. The music, the rise and fall of the voices, the muffled noise cloaked him in a haze after the quiet of the hotel room and the new disappointment. It was like a kaleidoscope of sleep, like a gentle hypnosis, enveloping the brain cells, their sketchy thoughts, and their tortured vigil. He saw Joan at some moment in the pale light mist in which the dancing couples moved. Her open, thirsty face was bent backward, her head close to a man's shoulder. It did not touch him. "No one can become more alien than a person one has loved once," he thought wearily. When the enigmatic umbilical cord between imagination and its object was torn, sheet lightning might still leap from one to the other. There might be fluorescence, as if from ghostly stars, but it was dead light. It excited, but it no longer set fire. Nothing any longer flowed to and fro. He leaned his head against the back of the banquette. The brief intimacy above abysses, the darkness of the sexes with all their sweet names, star flowers on a bog which swallowed you up when you started to pick them. He straightened up. He had to get out before he fell asleep. He called the waiter. "Check, please."
"There is nothing to pay for," the waiter said. "How is... you did not drink anything?"
"Oh, yes. That's right." He tipped the man and left.
"No?"
Morozov asked outside.
"No,"
Ravitch replied. Morozov looked at him. "I give up," Ravitch said. "It is a damned laughable game of Indians. For 5 days now I've been waiting. Harker told me that he always stays for only 2 or 3 days in Paris. If that's so, then he must have left again by now.
if he was here at all. Go to bed, Morozov said. I can't sleep. Now I'll drive back to the Prince de Galle, get my suitcase, and check out. All right, Morozov said. Then I'll meet you tomorrow noon there. Where? In the Prince de Galle. Ravitch looked at him. Yes, of course. I'm talking nonsense. Or am I? Maybe not. Wait until tomorrow night. All right, I'll see. Good night, Boris. Good night, Ravitch.
Ravitch drove past the Osiris. He parked the car around the corner. The thought of going back to his room in the Internationale made him shudder. Maybe he could sleep a few hours here. It was Monday, a quiet day for brothels. The doorman was no longer outside. Hardly anyone would still be in there. Roland stood beside the door, keeping watch over the big room. The music box made a lot of noise in the almost empty place.
Nothing much going on tonight? Ravitch asked.
Nothing. Only that bore over there. Lascivious as a monkey, but he doesn't want to go upstairs with a girl. You know the type. Would like to, but is afraid. Another German. Well, he has paid. It can't take much longer.
Ravitch looked indifferently toward the table. The man was sitting with his back to him. He had two girls with him. As he leaned toward one of them, taking both her breasts in his hands, Ravitch saw his face. It was Harker. He heard Roland speaking as if in a haze. He could not understand what she said. He realized only that he had stepped backward and was standing by the door now so that he could just see the corner of the table without being seen. Finally, Roland's voice came through the haze.
Some cognac?
The squawking of the music box, still the oscillation, the spasm in the diaphragm. Ravitch dug his nails into his palm. Harker must not see him here, and Roland must not notice that he knew him.
No, he heard himself saying, I've had enough.
A German, you said. Do you know who he is?
No idea. Roland shrugged her shoulders. They all look alike to me. I think this one has never been here before. But don't you want to have a drink?
No, only wanted to look in.
He felt Roland's eyes on him and forced himself to be calm.
I only wanted to hear when your party is, he said. Will it be Thursday or Friday?
Thursday, Ravitch. You are coming.
I'll be on time. That was all I wanted to know. Now I've got to go. Good night, Roland.
Good night, Ravitch.
The lighted night, suddenly roaring. No buildings any more. A thicket of stone, a jungle of windows. Suddenly war again, a crawling patrol along the empty street. The car, a shelter in which to take cover, the motor droning, lying in ambush for the enemy. Shoot him down when he comes out? Ravitch looked along the street. A few cars, yellow lights, stray cats. Under a street lamp in the distance, someone who looked like a policeman. His own license plate, the noise of the shot. Roland, who had just seen him. He heard Morozov's, Risk nothing, nothing, it isn't worth it. No doorman, no taxi, good. There were few fares on Mondays at this hour. The moment he had thought this, a Citroën taxi rattled past him and stopped at the door. The driver lit a cigarette and yawned audibly. Ravitch felt his skin contracting. He waited. He deliberated whether to step out and tell the driver that there was no longer anyone inside. Impossible. To send him away on some errand and pay him for it. To Morozov. He snatched a piece of paper out of his pocket, wrote a few lines, tore them up, wrote them again. Morozov should not wait for him at the Scheherazade, signed it with a fictitious name. The taxi went into gear and drove off. He stared after it, but could not see inside. He did not know whether Harker had stepped in while he had been writing. He went into first gear swiftly. The Talbot shot around the corner after the taxi. He could not see anyone through the back window, but Harker might be sitting at one side. He passed the taxi slowly. He could not recognize anything in the dark inside of the car. He fell back and again passed the other car as close as possible. The driver turned around and shouted at him,
Hey, you idiot, you want to run into me?
There is a friend of mine in your cab.
You drunken fool, the driver yelled. Can't you see the car is empty?
At that moment, Ravitch saw that the meter was not running. He made a sharp turn and raced back.
Harker was standing at the curb. He waved. "Hello, taxi!" Ravitch drove close to him and stepped on the brake. "Taxi?" Harker asked. "No." Ravitch leaned out of the window. "Hello," he said. Harker looked at him. His eyes contracted. "What?" "I think we know each other," Ravitch said in German. Harker bent forward. The suspicion disappeared from his face. "Mein Gott, Herr von Horn." "Correct, correct, Herr von Horn, of course. What a coincidence, my good man, where have you been all this time?" "Here in Paris. Come, step in. I didn't know you would be back so soon." "I've called you up several times. Did you change your hotel?" "No, it's still the Prince de Galles." Ravitch opened the door of the car. "Step in, I'll take you along. You won't get a taxi very easily at this time." Harker put one foot on the running board. Ravitch could feel his breath. He saw the red, overheated face. "Prince de Galles," Harker said. "Damn it, that's what it was. Called you at the George V." He laughed loudly. "Now I understand. Prince de Galles, of course, got the two mixed up. Didn't bring my old notebook with me. Thought I'd remember." Ravitch kept an eye on the entrance. It would be some time before anyone came out. The girls had to change first. Nevertheless, he had to get Harker into the car quickly. "Did you intend to go in?" Harker asked in a jovial tone. "I was thinking of it, but it's too late." Harker blew noisily through his nose. "You said it, friend. I was the last one. They are closing." "It doesn't matter. It's dull in there anyway. Let's go somewhere else. Come on." "Is anything still open?" "Of course. The really good places are just starting now. This is only for tourists." "Is that so? I thought this was really something." "Not at all. There are much better ones. This is nothing but a cat house." Ravitch stepped lightly on the accelerator several times. The motor roared and died down. He had calculated right. Harker carefully climbed onto the seat beside him. "Nice to see you again," he said. "Really, very nice." Ravitch reached across him and closed the door. "I am delighted, too." "Interesting place here. A lot of naked girls. To think the police permit it. Very likely most of them are sick, eh?" "One is never quite sure in such places." Ravitch let in the clutch. "Are there any places where one can be absolutely sure?" Harker bit off the end of a cigar. "I wouldn't like to go home with a dose. On the other hand, one lives only once." "Yes," Ravitch said, and handed him the electric lighter. "Where are we driving?" "How about a maison de rendezvous to begin with?" "What is that?" "A house where society ladies go to look for adventure." "What? Real society ladies?" "Yes. Women whose husbands are too old. Women who have boring husbands. Women whose husbands don't make enough money."
"But how? Well, they cannot simply... How do they manage it?"
"These women come there for one or more hours, as if for a cocktail or nightcap. Some of them can be called up. It isn't a brothel in the same sense as these in Montmartre. I know a very nice house in the middle of the Bois. The owner looks the way a duchess should look. Everything is extremely distinguished, discreet, and elegant." Ravitch spoke slowly and calmly, breathing slowly. He heard himself talking like a tourist's guide, but he forced himself to go on speaking in order to grow calmer. The veins in his arms trembled. He held on to the wheel tightly with both hands to control the trembling. "You will be surprised when you see the rooms," he said. "The furniture is genuine, carpets and tapestry old, the wine select, the service exquisite, and you may be absolutely sure as far as the women are concerned." Harker exhaled his cigar smoke. He turned to Ravitch.
"Listen, all that sounds wonderful, my dear Herr von Horn. There is only one question. Certainly this can't be cheap."
"Well, I assure you it is not expensive." Harker laughed hoarsely in some embarrassment.
"It depends on what you mean by that. We Germans with our limited foreign exchange."
Ravitch shook his head.
"I know the owner very well. She is indebted to me. She'll consider us special guests. When you come as a friend of mine, and very likely you will not be permitted to pay.
A few tips, if anything at all, less than you paid for one bottle in the Osiris.
Really?
You'll see. Harker moved in his seat.
Donavetta, that's really something.
He smiled broadly at Ravitch.
You seem to be informed. You must have rendered a good service to that woman.
Ravitch looked at him. He looked straight into his eyes. Sometimes places of this kind have difficulties with the authorities. Attempted blackmail. You know what I mean.
And how?
For a moment Harker pondered something.
Are you so influential here?
Oh, not really. A few friends in influential positions.
Well, that's something. We could use you to good advantage. Couldn't we have a talk about it sometime?
Well, certainly. How long are you staying in Paris?
Harker laughed. I always seem to meet you when I'm just about to leave. I'm going at 7:30 this morning.
He looked at the clock in the car.
In 2.5 hours. I wanted to tell you. Must be at the Gare du Nord by then.
Can we make it?
Oh, easily.
Do you have to go to your hotel before that?
Oh, no, my suitcase is at the station. I left the hotel this afternoon. Saved a day's rent that way. With our foreign exchange.
He laughed again. Suddenly Ravitch realized that he, too, was laughing. He pressed his hands tightly on the wheel. Impossible, he thought. This is impossible. Something will still happen to interfere. Such a chance is impossible. The fresh air made Harker feel the alcohol. His voice became slower and heavier. He fixed himself more comfortably in his corner and began to doze. His lower jaw dropped and his eyes closed. The car turned into the soundless darkness of the Bois. The headlights flew like white spectres in front of the car, plucking ghostly trees out of the dark. The odor of acacias rushed through the open window. The noise of the tires on the asphalt was gentle, incessant, as if it would never cease. The motor's familiar droning, deep and soft in the damp night air. The shimmer of a small pond on the left, the silhouette of willows showing brighter than the dark beaches behind them. Meadows covered with dew, nacreous, pale. The Route de Madrid, the Route de la Porte Saint-James, the Route de Neuilly, a sleepy house, the smell of the river, the Seine. Ravitch drove along the Boulevard de la Seine. Two barges floated on the moonlit water. A dog barked on the farther one. Voices came across the water. A light burned on the forward deck of the first barge. Ravitch did not stop the car. He kept it at an even speed, not to wake Harker, and drove along the Seine. He had intended to stop there. It was impossible. The barges were too close to the bank. He turned into the Rue de la Ferme, away from the river, back to the Allée de Longchamp. He stayed on it beyond the Allée de la Reine Marguerite, driving carefully, and then turned into the narrower roads. As he looked over at Harker, he saw that his eyes were open. Harker looked at him. He had raised his head without shifting and was looking at Ravitch. His eyes shone like blue glass balls in the faint light from the dashboard. It was like an electric shock.
"Awake?" Ravitch asked.
Harker did not answer. He looked at Ravitch. He did not move. Not even his eyes moved.
"Where are we?"
he asked finally.
"In the Bois de Boulogne, very near the Restaurant des Cascades."
"How long have we been driving?"
10 minutes.
It has been longer.
Hardly.
Before I fell asleep, I looked at the clock. We've been driving more than half an hour.
Really?
Ravitch said. I didn't think it was so long. We'll be there soon.
Harker's eyes had not left Ravitch.
Where?
At the Maison de Rendezvous.
Harker moved.
Drive back, he said.
Now?
Yes.
He was no longer drunk. He was clear-headed and awake. His face had changed. His joviality and bonhomie had disappeared. For the first time Ravitch saw again the face he had known, the face that had been engraved on his memory forever in the terror chamber of the Gestapo. And suddenly the uneasiness he had felt all along since he had met Harker disappeared, the feeling that he was going to kill a stranger who actually did not matter to him. In his car he had had an amiable drinker of red wine, and he had searched in vain for reasons in that man's face, for the reasons that were uppermost in his mind, no matter what he tried to think of. Now, suddenly, they were again the same eyes he had seen before him when he had awakened out of unconsciousness in an agony of pain. The same cold eyes, the same cold, low, penetrating voice. Something in Ravitch reversed direction abruptly. It was like a current changing poles. The tension remained, but the vacillation, the nervousness, and the uncertainty were converted into a single current which had only one aim, and nothing was left but that. Years fell into ashes. The room with its grey walls was back again. The unshaded white lights, the smell of blood, leather, sweat, pain, and fear. "Why?" Ravitch asked. "I must go back. I'm expected at the hotel."
"But you said your things were already at the station."
"Yes, they are. But I've still got to settle something before I leave. I had forgotten all about it. Drive back."
"All right."
During the last week, Ravitch had driven through the Bois a dozen times during the daytime and at night. He recognized where he was. Still a few minutes. He turned to the left into a narrow road.
"Are we going back?"
"Yes." The heavy aroma under trees through which no sun shone during the day. The denser darkness. The brighter gleam of the headlights. Ravitch saw in the mirror that Harker's left hand was stealing away from the door, slowly, carefully. "Right-hand drive," he thought. "Thank God this Talbot has a right-hand drive." He took a curve, held the wheel with his left hand, pretended to sway with the turns, then accelerated on the straight road. The car raced ahead, and a few seconds later he stepped on the brake with all his strength. The Talbot bucked. The brake screeched. Ravitch held one foot on the brake, the other was pushed against the floor for balance. Harker, whose feet had no support and who had not expected the jolt, shot forward from the waist. He could not get his hand out of his pocket in time, and his forehead crashed against the edge of the windshield and the dashboard. At this moment, Ravitch struck him in the neck, just below the head, with the heavy monkey wrench he had taken from the right side pocket. Harker did not rise. He was slumped sidewise. His right shoulder kept him from slipping down. It jammed his body against the dashboard. Ravitch drove on at once. He crossed the avenue and dimmed the headlights. He drove on and waited to see if anyone had heard the screeching of the brakes. He deliberated whether to pull Harker out of the car and hide him behind the bushes in case anyone came by. Finally, he stopped beside a crossroad, switched off the lights and the motor, jumped out of the car, lifted the hood, opened the door, and listened. If anybody came, he could see and hear him at a distance. Time enough then to drag Harker behind a bush and to act as if something were wrong with the motor. The silence was like a noise. It was so sudden and inconceivable that it hummed. Ravitch clenched his hands until it hurt. He knew it was his blood that was humming in his ears. He breathed deeply and slowly. The humming grew into a roaring. Through the roaring he heard a shrill sound which grew louder. Ravitch listened with all his might. It grew louder, metallic. Then suddenly he realized that it was made by crickets and that the roaring had ceased. There were only the crickets in the awakening day on a narrow strip of a meadow diagonally in front of him. The meadow lay bathed in the early light. Ravitch closed the hood. It was high time. He had to get through with it before there was too much light. He looked about. This place was not good. No place in the Bois was good. It was too light along the Seine. He hadn't counted on its being so late. He whirled around. He had heard a scraping and scratching, then a groaning. One of Harker's hands had crept out of the open car door and was scratching along the running board. Ravitch realized then that he still held the monkey wrench in his hand. He seized Harker by the collar of his coat, lifted him so that the head came free, and struck him twice. The groaning ceased. Something clattered. Ravitch stood still. Then he saw that it was a revolver that had dropped from the seat onto the running board. Harker must have been holding it before the brake had been applied. Ravitch flung it back into the car. He listened again. The crickets, the meadow, the sky that became lighter and seemed to recede. In a little while the sun would be out. Ravitch opened the door, dragged Harker out of the car, pushed the front seat down, and tried to shove Harker onto the floor of the car between the back seat and the front seat. It would not do. There was not enough room. He walked around the car and opened the trunk. He emptied it quickly.
Then he pulled Harker out of the car again and dragged him to the back. Harker was not yet dead. He was very heavy. Sweat ran down Ravitch's face. He succeeded in squeezing the body into the trunk. He forced him in like an embryo with the knees doubled up. He took the tools, a shovel and a car jack from the ground, and put them in the front of the car. A bird began to sing in a tree near him. He was startled. It seemed louder than anything he had ever heard. He looked at the meadow. It had become still lighter. He could not take any chances. He went back and half-lifted the cover of the trunk. He put his left foot on the rear fender and kept the cover half-open with his knee, just high enough to reach under it easily with his hands. If anyone came by, it would look as if he were harmlessly working at something, and he could immediately let the cover drop. There was a long ride ahead. He had to kill Harker first. The head was near the right-hand corner. He could see it. The neck was soft. The arteries still pulsed. He pressed his hands firmly around Harker's throat and held tight. It seemed to take forever. The head moved a little, only a little. The body tried to stretch out. It seemed trapped in its clothes. The mouth opened. Shrilly the bird began to warble again. The tongue was thick, with a yellow coating, and suddenly Harker opened one eye. It protruded, seemed to gain light and vision, seemed to free itself and to come toward Ravitch. Then the body yielded. Ravitch still held on for a time. Done. The cover slammed shut. Ravitch took a few steps. Then he leaned against a tree and vomited. He felt as if his stomach were being wrenched out. He tried to check it. It did not help. When he looked up, he saw a man coming across the meadow. The man was staring at him. Ravitch stayed where he was. The man approached. His gait was slow, unconcerned. He was dressed like a gardener or worker. He looked at Ravitch. Ravitch spat and took a pack of cigarettes out of his pocket. He lighted one and inhaled the smoke. The smoke rasped and burnt in his throat. The man crossed the road. He looked at the place where Ravitch had vomited, and then at the car, and then at Ravitch. He did not say anything, and Ravitch could not read anything in the man's face. He disappeared beyond the crossroad with slow steps. Ravitch waited a few seconds more. Then he locked the trunk of the car and started the motor. There was nothing more to be done in the Bois. It was too light. He must drive to Saint-Germain. He knew the woods there.